Hi, it's Brock Romanek, editor of the CorporateCounsel.net. I'm here today with Ning Chu, who's at Davis Polk. Ning and I were together last week at the Society of Corporate Secretaries annual conference and got to listen to Keith Higgins, the CorpFin director, get interviewed by Shelley Dropkin, and it was a really good interview. So we're going to recap what Keith said. We will note that he made a disclaimer, but we don't have to summarize it. That's, I guess, once removed. So the first question for you, Ning, is pay ratio. We got a proposal last year. What about timing? What did Keith say there?
Unfortunately, Keith specifically declined to give us a sense of any kind of timing. He did say that the staff was reviewing the hundreds of specific comments they did get, not to mention the thousands of form letters. He raised two issues that I think a lot of people have already heard him talk about in other contexts. One is the requirement to include all global employees. On that, he reiterated the point that the statute itself does say all employees should be required in the calculation. He was a bit more sympathetic to the notion of including part-time employees or not. He did understand that it does seem to be kind of a disparity to compare part-time versus full-time pay, but the question is, what's the solution for that? Could they actually mandate ignoring thousands or hundreds of thousands of part-time employees? And if they permit full-time equivalent calculations, would that end up being more burdensome and costly to companies? There wasn't really an answer to any of these things, so it's sort of a to come. And the most important thing is he didn't give us any kind of expected timing on that or any of the other three that we're still waiting for. He did mention that they thought that pledging and hedging rules would be the easiest of the remaining three. The clawback would be the hardest. And on pay for performance, they're struggling with the concept of what actually paid might mean, and they're studying carefully the notion of realized and realizable pay. The next thing he also talked about is disclosure reform, which Brock's going to cover.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say that on the timing, and of course no CorpFin director ever would ever give away the timing of any of these because they don't know really. It's powers that be in the building above them that really dictate when this stuff gets out. But he did note the Reg Flex agenda that says that these things will be out in October. But as I've blogged about, the Reg Flex agenda is aspirational. So I find it curious that he even referenced them, but I guess that was sort of a heads up. You know, it could come this year. On disclosure reform, which I continue to call that, but now the staff and I think everyone else is calling it disclosure effectiveness. Again, there was no timing mentioned by Keith. He did mention that teams of staffers, even within operations, are working on it now. I know that the ABA and other groups like the Society are accelerating their own homework, giving guidance to the SEC about what they think should be included. And I think a lot of those groups are focused on getting something by the fall, so they might know something from the staff that we don't. Keith didn't mention this, but I believe when we do start seeing things from the SEC, they're going to start with the 34 Act and then move on to the 33 Act. But again, I don't know if that's what will be seen. Keith did mention that, you know, we as disclosure professionals should be enhancing the effectiveness of our own disclosure on our own, something that I've written about. And so, you know, he's saying do the homework to rethink what you've been writing for many years. And he also talked about risk factors a little bit as an example of an area where even though CYA is important, the risk factors, the proliferation of them has gotten out of control. I know I talked to one person at the conference that mentioned back in the day when there were fewer risk factors, you know, they thought investors really might have read them, but now that there's so many that they've all just, you know, people's eyes just glaze over it and they have no impact at all.
Right. And the other thing he also discussed is sort of repetitive disclosure, sort of the same disclosure that ends up in different sections. Those seem to be the main topics that people can agree upon more or less. But he did note that there are some investors who think that there should be more rather than less disclosure, and we can debate what more there could be, but, you know, there is sort of a contingent that still wants more. Another item he addressed was a 14A stakeholder meeting that the staff held with issuers, issuer representatives, proponents of shareholder proposals, and their representative. Two primary issues came out of that really goes to the heart of what some of the retail proponents have been focused on, and that is the question of whether there can be representation by proxy where you designate another shareholder to be the main contact and the main person who handles a shareholder proposal, including submitting it and seeing it all the way through. It sounds like the general agreement was that in concept it's allowed, but the question is whether certain types of appropriate authorization needs to be shown and what that type of authorization may be. The second big issue that we saw during this proxy season, some of the no action letters and a court case, is a question of when there is a false and misleading statement in the supporting statement portion of a shareholder proposal. This would be a demonstrably false misleading statement as opposed to something that may be an opinion. And the issuers and their representative raised the question of to the staff of what their recourse may be when this happens. The staff doesn't want to be debating by line item each statement in the supporting statement, but perhaps if there is something demonstrably false, perhaps that statement, that particular line item, may be taken out. And those were some of the issues that were raised at the 14A8 stakeholder meeting. It wasn't clear whether we might be getting guidance before the fall season starts.
One topic I wanted to address is one that Keith didn't get asked about, but he decided to raise it on his own, and that's interim vote tallies. And the aspect he raised was a position that CorpFin has taken, that Broadridge's role in this process, when you look at the definition of solicitation under Rule 14A1, it talks about an exemption from solicitation if there's someone involved that is impartial. And Keith mentioned that Broadridge's role was deemed to be impartial, and so that they would be exempt from the definition of solicitation. So to better understand what I'm talking about, Rule 14A1, I would refer you to a great article that Keir Gomes of Covington & Burling wrote on this interim vote tallies that's posted in our voting instruction form practice area. Ning, do you want to talk about proxy advisor guidance? Of course, at the time, the staff hadn't put it out, but Keith mentioned it, and now we have it.
Yes. So on this topic, it's not so much about what Keith said. He actually didn't say much except that it is coming, and of course we did get it last night. So this is more a summary of what it is that we ended up getting rather than a summary of what Keith said about it. We got it in the form of Staff Legal Bulletin 20, which was issued by the Office of Investment Management, the Office of Corporation Finance. I'm just going to preface it by saying that it's going to be a bit disappointing to corporate issuers because it doesn't even begin to address most corporate issuers' concerns and maybe their hopes and dreams about what this guidance could have provided, including accessibility to draft reports or even getting a report for free at all, or some of the transparencies around proxy advisory firm methodologies. What it does talk about in a set of 13 Q&As is the investment advisor's responsibility when they delegated, as is permitted, to a third party to assist them fulfilling their own voting obligations. Investment advisors are required to vote in accordance with their client wishes, and the staff legal bulletin makes clear that that could mean that they don't have to vote at all. They only vote a certain way on certain types of proposals with management, with a particular proponent, or abstaining. So there's broad flexibility on that. Investment advisors are required to establish policies and procedures to make sure they vote in accordance with their client's wishes. And they must take steps to ensure compliance with those policies and procedures, and that might include taking some sample votes afterwards to make sure they're consistent. They also need to undertake due diligence on any third party, such as proxy advisory firms that they delegate in making voting recommendations to or establishing policies and procedures. And that includes checking on the qualifications and the competence and the staffing of the third parties, the proxy advisory firms, the accuracy and completeness of the reports. If there is a material mistake that is made in the proxy advisory firm report, the investment advisors need to investigate that. So that addresses one of those issues that had continually come up about errors in proxy advisory firm reports, but note that they made clear these would have to be pretty material errors. Then it goes on to talk about conflict of interest that the proxy advisory firms may have. That would include ISS providing consulting services to corporate issuers, or if shareholder proposal proponents or dissidents who have names on the of nominees on the ballot are clients of the proxy advisory firms. And those proxy advisory firms must provide disclosures of the conflict of interest, which are specific, can't be boilerplate, and they can't just say they'll simply provide that upon request. But one important thing to note is that the staff legal bulletin doesn't say this disclosure needs to be made public. That is between ISS and Glass Lewis, the proxy advisory firms, and their clients as to how this disclosure is made. So that will also be a little bit of a disappointment to corporate issuers who are hoping to address the conflict in a public way.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, as of the time of this taping, we haven't seen any law firm memos on the guidance. Probably a combination of people already being on vacation, but also people scrambling to figure out if how much of the staff legal bulletin really says anything new. And I agree, there's really not much here for corporate issuers in terms of the change of how their lives will be going forward.
Right. I think it, as the Wall Street Journal, I think, even had a small story, not even in today's paper, but a small story. I think that wording they use is it will have little practical impact on companies, and I think that will turn out to be true. They may not even feel any difference once this guidance is implemented.
The last thing I just wanted to mention was that in response to a question, Keith talked a little bit about conflict minerals in terms of whether there was going to be a staff review project of reviewing the disclosure. First, Keith noted that there was weird timing on the disclosure requirement, both because part of the rule was struck down right before companies were all required to make their first filings, and also because the rule went into effect in the heart of the proxy season. So I think reading through the tea leaves there, you know, disclosures may be a little bit ragged, a little bit uneven, and maybe that wouldn't be the case with another year of experience. Those are my words, not Keith's. But to that effect, he indicated that the staff made the review project on the disclosures, and it was unknown at this time whether it would be on the disclosures just made or that the staff would wait another year and see what the disclosures look like next year. And then after reviewing the disclosures, maybe there would be some further interpretive guidance, something that the staff has done often over the decades whenever there's a big rule change like this. But there was no word from Keith about whether there would be more interpretive guidance ahead of a disclosure project. I know I've received some interpretive questions, including one on the definition of tin that, you know, I'm not a conflict minerals expert, thankfully, and still trying to figure out what that all means, but glad I'm not having to do it myself. So there we have it, Ning. We didn't talk about our favorite movies and songs like Dave and Marty, but I think we gave the people what they wanted, so I appreciate your time.
I'm sure you're here, whether or not you did. Thank you.
Thanks, Ning.
All right. Bye-bye.